Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Did you know that Off Camera was also a television show? Well, if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you know that we are a podcast, a magazine, and a television show. But what you may not know is you can watch full episodes in glorious black and white on our own website, offcamera.com. And now we've made that even easier by creating a monthly subscription so you can watch all the Off Camera you want. For only $4.99, you can subscribe to Off Camera and binge watch until the cows come home. And not only that, but new episodes pop up every week, so you can always stay up to date with the show. If you haven't yet checked it out, it's a whole different way to experience Off Camera. As you're listening to these stories, you can watch these thoughts form on these artists' faces, and it feels like you're right there in the room during the conversation. So check that out. It's a great option to the podcast, and it's also a great way to support the show. So check that out at offcamera.com. Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with comedian and writer John Mulaney. For John Mulaney, it all started with Ricky Ricardo. That's when the self-described adult in a child's body discovered the appeal of life in show business. You sit around the house all day, then you pop down to the nightclub for a tight 10. Add his love of everything funny and some outrageous childhood experiences to the mix, and it's no wonder John became a comedian, even if it's an unexpected choice for the son of two lawyers. John had a knack for wordplay and joke rhythms as a kid, but he started fleshing out his skills when he joined Georgetown's improv troupe, a breeding ground for comics like Nick Kroll and Mike Birbiglia. Discomfort and anxiety plagued John early on, but joining Birbiglia's stand-up tour helped him overcome the awkwardness of being on stage. As John says, "Mike absolutely turned me into a comedian. The tour was life-changing. I wanted to do stand-up every night after that." John also spent 6 seasons as a comedy writer for Saturday Night Live, and he was the brains behind fan-favorite sketches and characters like Bill Hader's Stefan. The job came with a lot of responsibility, but John loved it. He says, "I was a producer of live TV at age 25. Once my sketch was picked, I would go around to every department, discussing with them how it would look, the costume, the set, everything you were hoping for." These days, John's making us laugh with his stand-up. His Netflix comedy special, John Mulaney, Kid Gorgeous at Radio City, offers a hilarious and very personal glimpse of his childhood and family life. And he takes no prisoners. As Philip Roth opines, "Once a writer is born into the family is finished." And what a writer John is, noticing the smallest, oddest details about humanity and finding great significance and humor in them. John joins Off Camera to discuss mining his life for comedy, why it's best to have no expectations, and why we all need a little bit of street smarts in our lives. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, John.
Hi, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I will say before we start that the theme music we just heard is probably the only thing that this show has in common with your Radio City show, in that both of our shows have John Bryan composing our theme music.
The great John Bryan, yes.
The great John Bryan, although that's where the similarities end. Because we don't have 1,000 people here.
Well, and yours was pre-recorded. He played ours live on the Mighty Wurlitzer organ at Radio City. Yes.
Which is amazing. And, you know, watching your routine, one of the things that I think is misunderstood about comedy is...
Everything.
Everything, yes. Like how nebulous it is when something works. I think that someone watching comedy goes... Oh, when they wrote that, they knew it was funny, and they knew...
Yeah.
Like, I guess I'm curious about that idea of the sensibility of a comedian versus just a kid who occasionally made people laugh. Like, was there an awareness at some point in your life where you go, oh, not only am I sort of funny, but I sort of see the architecture of how this works?
That's an interesting question. I very early thought, this is not just something to absorb and laugh at. I want to do that.
Like, how old were you?
When I was about 5, I'd say it started with Ricky Ricardo on I Love Lucy.
Oh,
I thought, oh, I want to do that. I want to work in a nightclub and I want to have my day free. That actually is my first memory of, like, of wanting to be in show business. At the same time, I also loved any funny movie, you know, any funny cartoon. I loved Ernie from Bert and Ernie, that he was like always goofing around, took nothing seriously, and that Bert was really pissed off about
it. Right.
I genuinely found that dynamic funny. So I liked everything funny and thought everything was funny. And my mom would say, not everything is funny. And I really thought it was.
And that was funny when she would say that.
Well, it says, yes. Yeah, I was also a crier and a dramatic kid too, but I did find a lot of things amusing. And I liked comedy. And so I don't remember a time when I didn't want to do that.
So when did you figure out, okay, I can't just not work all day and go to the nightclub at night. I have to prepare something.
Prepare.
Yeah.
Oh.
Do you remember the first time you wrote a joke and said, oh, this is funny, this is...
I remember having jokes when I was a kid.
That you actually created.
That I said. They weren't written, you know. But I was trying to ape joke rhythms and, you know, what I thought, like, wordplay was. Like, I went to a birthday party and the mother of the birthday boy said, oh, that's a sharp shirt you have on. I said, yeah, it's sharp. Sometimes I use it instead of scissors. And I was like, that sounds like a joke. And all the adults laughed because it was like, you know, a 3-foot-tall person talking. But
right.
I was like, yeah, that's how jokes sound.
Right.
Yeah. And it makes a little sense. And it's not a terrible joke.
No, it's a pun, I think. Is it a pun?
It's a poorly thought out wordplay. That's a sharp shirt. Yeah, sometimes I use it instead of a knife would be better, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a sharp
shirt.
What if you
had taken
it to... That would have been faster and funnier.
Or if you had said, yes, if you need help with the birthday cake later, I can...
Well, now we're getting too wordy again. That's a sharp shirt. Better than a dull shirt. Nice to see you, lady. That would have been great. And
right.
Then exit. Leave the birthday party.
Get out quick.
Mm-hmm.
So I was curious if, as you go along in this, if you find that, like, that the more personal you get or the more you talk about yourself, it's more like you're developing your voice even more through that rather than just simply writing observational bits.
Yes, I like to mine my life more now. And I like to also not present it as jokes.
Right.
I think that came from people asking if the stories were real. And it's like, well, of course they're real. If I could make up stories, crazier things would happen. Normally it's just some events, but hopefully told funny, you know.
Well, you know, it's funny. I had that same question. I'm like, how much of this could be true? So I went and I Googled J.J. Bittenbinder.
Yeah.
You have this...
I scratched the surface.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so just... So people understand that haven't seen your special, you talk about J.J. Bittenbinder.
Detective J.J. Bittenbinder.
Who was what, a Chicago child homicide investigator?
I don't know what department it was called in the Chicago Police Department. He seemed to be a child homicide expert.
Right. And he would come and present sort of a stranger danger assembly.
Yes. And this was in grade school at St. Clement Grammar School, St. Clement Grade School, you know, K through 8.
Right.
This would start when you were about 6 or 7. The whole school on up, sitting in the gym, you never knew it was coming. It was sprung on you. They were just like, go to the gym. And then Detective J.J. Bittenbinder would walk in, and he wore a 3-piece suit, a pocket watch. He wore a big red tie. 2 years in a row, he wore a cowboy hat, but other years he didn't. And he had a huge handlebar mustache. I mean, he had a perfectly coiffed handlebar mustache and auburn hair parted down the middle.
And so I looked this guy up, and if anything, he was a little crazier in his own video specials about street smarts or whatever.
Oh, I left out things that would just get such gasps that I couldn't recover.
Right.
Even though they were said to me when I was a kid, adults in a comedy audience on this tour would be like, ah, but he would lay these truths on us that were just terrifying. He went up to a girl once, I don't think she was in my grade, but let's say 8 or 9, not an old person. And he said, what would you do if someone started chasing you? She went, I would run. He goes, no, you drop your backpack first, then you run. And then he stands up and goes, I know what your dad told you. Don't you ever lose that backpack. That backpack was... By the way, backpack is one of the best words for Chicago people to say. Don't you lose that backpack. that backpack was expensive. First off, none of us really related to, like, was like, I don't recall a, like, don't you ever lose your backpack, it's expensive conversation. Not saying they're not expensive, just that he thought that was a, you know, we all would relate. I don't know. He goes, don't you ever lose your backpack. He told you that backpack cost a fortune. Don't you ever lose it. But what would you rather come home without, your backpack or your underwear? And I remember going, Jesus Christ. I was like 7 and was like, yah-ga-ga. Get this guy out of here.
Would you say yah-ga-ga?
No. I probably went.
What's funny is that I'm just watching this, and first I look up the real guy, and I go, okay, this is all real. And secondly, it made me question how aware you were of the surreal nature of this, or that adults were weird. And, like, did you have an awareness at that young age that there were some idiotic things that the adults were making you do?
Yes. I had two feelings at once. One, I am an adult. I am a citizen. I should be able to walk down the street. When I was, you know, 9 years old, I'd go buy a magazine and go to a diner and read it. I had no concept of, yeah, that to me was, you know, if my parents were working and I was off, it was the summer, I'd go for a walk and buy like a Rolling Stone and go read it at like a diner. And I thought, like, this is normal, and that must have looked very weird. Very weird for a kid to come in and go, like, I'll have a glass of water, please. Just read a magazine.
So you were a tiny adult in your
head. I was like, don't hassle me. I'm not a kid, you know? At the same time, conversely, I, like, knew adults had control over me, and I couldn't stand it.
Did those kinds of experiences with J.J. Bittenbinder, did they lodge themselves in your psyche? Like, were you terrified as a kid?
Of being kidnapped and murdered, yes.
You were?
Absolutely. I thought it was almost an inevitability.
Really? Because that's how it was presented to you.
And I don't mean to be too dark, but it was, you know, Eitan Peitz. Every sitcom had an episode where if there was a youth, they would be interfered with. Different Strokes had the Mr. Bicycle Man episode. Different Strokes had another episode where they're almost molested. Then Different Strokes had the episode where Sam is kidnapped.
Clearly, you should not have been watching Different Strokes.
Clearly, Different Strokes maybe shouldn't have happened, even though it was a very funny show. A lot of people got hurt. But I felt like every sitcom I watched would have a very special episode about a camp counselor or a stranger or someone harming a child to the point that I was like, well, I guess it's just us versus them.
This eventually happens to everybody.
Yeah, or just walk down the street like, what do you want? What do you want? You know.
So how did that manifest? Were you like a nervous kid?
Yeah, I've been nervous for 35 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Are you nervous now?
My fists are clenched.
It's the strangest thing to me, because what you do is the career for the most potential for whatever you're nervous about to come true. Like having to be funny, having to go on stage and put yourself out there vulnerably, telling your personal stories in front of a crowd.
Right.
Someone who's nervous, I would think they would avoid that as a profession.
Well, to be totally accurate, there are times I have a little stage fright. But in terms of the larger question, I guess I don't have anxiety about that, you know, because it's so fun to me. My anxieties are about everything else.
Getting put in a trunk.
Yeah, just the like, if I, you know, being duped by a kidnapper. I still, when I, you know, on this tour, the tour bus would pull up at a truck stop and I'd go to the bathroom and I'd be like, shouldn't I be accompanied by an adult, you know, like... Gas stations, I'm always like, this is where it goes down.
Is Bittenbinder still like...
Yeah, he's in my head. Like, I actually told my wife about... Now, I knew he was funny back then, but it was retelling it to my wife this summer that I realized it was very funny. But he was also a scary figure in my head.
Well, okay, so what I'm curious about is what happens when you examine your own childhood for material in terms of what you learn about yourself. Like, what comes up?
Well, things will come up where I'll say to someone, because I'm actively trying to, you know, generate memories or ideas. It's not like I'm just fracking my memory all day long, but I do go like, let's see. I've never done anything about when I went to camp in Minnesota. Was there anything that? I will like try to think of something.
You will.
I will go to an area and that normally doesn't work. Actually, someone will, we would just be talking and you would say a word and I would remember something my Nana said that I haven't thought about in 20 years. And then I would ask you if it was funny and you would, and with some of the ones that are interesting, people go, what? Like someone, like that, like someone said that when you were a kid? And I'll be like, yes, did that happen to you? And they'll be like, no. And I'll be like, great, I've got something.
Okay, so then you take that. What do you do with it then? Because you got something and you have an impression, but you don't have a full
bit.
Story. Yeah.
Right. Toss it in with a similar already crafted bit. See if I can attach it to something that works.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's how like most. That's how I'll normally build things. I'll like throw it in like. If I had a story about a Thanksgiving dinner, I'd go, my uncle, who, by the way, became an EMT, even though he was blind, just whatever, the detail is. And that's my example of a story. Became an EMT because he was blind. I said that EMT because I overheard my grandmother say when I was in Boston recently, well, of course, she got divorced because she wanted to become an EMT. And I didn't, I was like, what? And the moment was over, I couldn't ask, like, hey, what did you just say? But EMT is stuck in my head because of that. Anyway, I would just toss in a detail. And if it got a big laugh, I'd go, okay, my uncle's time as a blind EMT, which is not a real thing, I will now make its own thing.
I see. So it's almost like from the very beginning of developing a bit, you have to put it out in front of an audience. You can't sit and take something to completion at a desk.
Oh, no. Absolutely not. It's a performed art form.
See, that's interesting. I think that that's something a lot of people might not assume.
Some might disagree with me, too.
Right,
I'm sure
right.
Stephen Wright, Dimitri Martin, Mitch Hedberg could write and go, I know what this is fully. I totally could be disagreed with and correctly. But for me, it's like a performed medium.
That's so interesting because I was curious, once you get good at this, can you make almost anything funny by putting it in front of an audience, finding out it doesn't work, and going back?
Like in other words, like to the woodshed with it.
Well, you have this bit about the gazebo.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm listening to this bit, and the basic deal is that you saw a plaque on a gazebo
in Connecticut,
made during the Civil War.
It said that this was built by the town in 1863.
Right, and so deconstructing, I'm assuming you actually saw that plaque
yeah.
on a gazebo.
Yeah.
And then your brain started doing this. Like this.
I was eating ice cream and I was sitting there and I was going, huh.
Yeah, and this is something I wouldn't do. I wouldn't go, well, what else was going on in the Civil War? Everyone's sons and uncles and fathers were getting massacred.
Well, 1863 was Gettysburg, so I knew there was that. You know.
Right. But I think that's what a great stand-up does, is they go, well, what does that look like from the townspeople? What does it look like when he pitches the idea of the gazebo? And I wonder if that's even
Well, that's interesting. I always feel like I just have one take, one way in, and it might have a lot of tangents and funny things, but it's one way in. Foolish use of time during the Civil War. People of Connecticut build the gazebo. But maybe the gazebo cheered them up during the Civil War,
but you've
which
got
is not addressed.
You've got like a town hall meeting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's different people echoing my own point.
So that begs the question of, are you always at work?
I don't think so, no.
But I mean, in the terms of the gazebo, you wandered into a gazebo eating some ice cream.
Yeah,
and
not
the
working.
Thing happened.
Yeah.
But then you're working.
Well, I guess I am susceptible to odd things.
Yeah.
And upset people. I notice them, but I'm not journaling in the middle of Grand Central Station trying to come up with things.
So in other words, you don't wake up at 9 in the morning and say, I'm going to go on my comedy walk now and I'm going to go look for...
No, but walks are good, strangely. My friend Dan Mintz always walks at night. Until his wife asked him to stop because he was just walking
because
around.
Because of Bittenbinder.
He was just walking around like, you know, Hollywood Boulevard at night to generate ideas. That's your business, Dan, but I am sharing it publicly. Walks are good. And when I was in Brooklyn and kind of had nothing to do but stand up before Saturday Night Live, I do think I wandered around and I knew I had a set and I would think about the jokes. So there was more thinking, writing, typing out then.
Right, right.
With touring, you're fortunate enough to have some of that time, but more you get to say it, see like, oh, that part of that story got the biggest laugh. I didn't expect that. Let's go down that avenue. I had a story about my mom telling me just very recently that our house was haunted when we were growing up.
Right, which is kind of one of the beginning bits of Kid Gorgeous.
Yeah, I think it's the first bit, because Radio City felt haunted. and that's the story I wanted to tell. And then I told it probably numerous times on tour with just the fact that my dad said, after my mom was explaining that she used to see a ghost of a Victorian girl in a nightgown walking down our hallway, my dad said, "Let's change the subject." And the joke was like how weird it was that he wanted to change the subject. He must have killed that little girl.
Right.
And then...
Which is something that only your brain can produce.
Well...
That's when it's really you. That's.
I appreciate that. I do find like with relatability, like just don't worry about that. Like just be hyper specific to your own life. And you'll probably end up hitting more people on some level by being hyper specific rather than trying to gloss over. If I made my dad sound like kind of every dad on TV, you know, if I tried to broaden his appeal,
right?
People would be like, ah, okay.
But yeah, he's a dad, but I can't get a picture of him.
Yeah, I go, my dad was not like your dad. My dad was this like stern guy or maybe he was in many cases. But my dad was not the dumb dad on a sitcom.
Right.
So I think being specific often hits whatever you want, whatever part of the brain you want relatability to hit. In the case of that joke, the end of it was, you know, he must have killed that girl. And then one night I said, "Dad, there's, none of us really knows our father." And that got a huge laugh. And I was like...
Oh, that was a throwaway.
Yeah, one night it was a throwaway. And then I thought, I think in the moment I said, like, my dad's so weird, I'd love to meet him someday. And that kind of worked. And then I thought, okay, maybe I left that alone for a few weeks. And I would do it again and again. And then if an audience is kind of rolling with it, I'd be like, in fact, one time, and I might have these already jotted down, but, you know, okay, if you're with me, I want to tell you about this time that we got into an argument at the dinner table where he heightened it to the point of how are you better than a Nazi in a moral equivalency. And then, yeah, so it's just like, that to me was a story about how my mom never told us there was a ghost. The funny ending was the thing about my dad. And then it begat a few more stories that are in the opening of the special.
It's so interesting how that's how something evolves if you let it evolve rather than trying to grab hold of it.
And if you are fortunate enough to have the attentive audience.
When you're talking, I realize what you do and what ends up being successful up on that stage is the product of completely different, different work than I thought it was.
In my case, yeah, maybe. Like sometimes the effort goes into just the foundation. And then all these flourishes just come naturally in the moment.
But you're willing to chase those flourishes and find out that there's a whole story there. Like, is that what you're looking for as a comedian? Are you looking for little doors that open and all of a sudden there's so much more?
I like that phrase a lot.
Yeah?
I like that phrase. Yeah. I'd say, yeah, you're looking at like, a little door, but one where you're like, that's little, but there's a lot behind that, you know? Like, if I jot an idea down, it will seem like it could be a one-liner or a very short joke. But, you know, sometimes I go, I bet I could get a lot out of that, because that's a deep subject and I have a lot of anger or exasperation over it, and something strikes either the delighted or the annoyed part of my brain, and you go, Not only do I care, but I could talk for 20 minutes about it.
I think that's the thing we want in artists. We want to get a sense of who they really are, either to find out how similar we are or how different we are. And,
yeah.
and both is satisfying.
Yes, totally.
Yeah.
And I always think that there's proper acclaim given to confessional, self-revelatory, sometimes dark writing or performing or stand-up, whatever it is. And there's a lot of proper acclaim given to how revelatory that is. But there are things that people ignore in observational humor or just jokes that seem small where you go, that's that whole person right there.
Right.
And like I do sometimes think, you know, well, there's jokes that seem just like an innocuous everyday observation that are as dark about human nature as any real, you know, tear open your guts and show all the horrible sides of you comedy, both of which are great. But one thing that gets ignored sometimes is like the fact that they're talking about this or the way they talked about this mundane thing says so much, you know. Like I think one of the darkest jokes I've ever heard is Seinfeld has a joke, maybe it's from in the past 5 years or so, where he's talking about how they keep telling you to clean up after yourself at the movies. And he's like, no, I've paid $13, I'm doing it poorly, and I apologize. Both the voice, I realized I was about to do the voice. I gotta do it a little, okay. And I'm getting the joke wrong, and it's horrible. I've paid $13 for the ticket, I've paid $8 for the popcorn, I paid $7 for the soda. When I'm done, I open my hand. And like that line, like I open my hand and the way he says it, to me are like, yeah, that's as like dark and shitty as we are as human beings. Like, no, you clean it up. Like that's as much as being like, I left my wife and kids because I'm God. You know, like that is like, we all relate to like, yeah, sometimes I go, no, I'm not throwing that away.
Do you think that he's even aware of how dark that is?
I don't know. I mean, I watched the special that I just put out editing it. And I realized, I was like, oh, I'm not aware of anything about myself.
Really?
Yeah.
Like the more you examine, the less you're aware.
Yeah, the you know, I am like a bridge over river Kwai where like I forgot what I was supposed to be doing.
Right.
Is that a good analogy? No, I'm wondering. Yeah, it's pretty good. He builds the bridge because he's a prisoner of war. In the end, he takes so much pride in the bridge that he almost ruins his own side blowing up the bridge. That's not perfect for the analogy. But for someone who's like, I observe everything about my life, there's things in the special that I didn't even connect that I'm like, oh, weird.
I thought it was interesting that in the special you reveal that you got your wife's permission to talk about her in the act, but that you have not even talked to your father about the sex talk you had, but you're sharing it with Radio City.
Yes, he hadn't seen it before that. And it was definitely going in regardless.
Hey, it's gotta be tough to be the parent of a comedian.
You know, Philip Roth said, when a writer's born into the family is finished.
Yeah.
But I'm aware of how much I share about the people I love, and they like it.
You have this bit about your father pulling into a McDonald's on a road trip,
yeah.
and all the kids in the car, you and your brothers and sisters,
yeah.
are so excited because you didn't think you were going to get McDonald's even
yeah.
though you asked for it. And he pulls into the drive-thru and he orders a single black coffee
yeah.
and drives on.
Yeah.
And that's revealing your father's character yeah. at
And
at
how
its
funny
core.
He was.
Funny,
that's
but
a
also,
very funny thing to do.
Also, just like, that's mean.
Yeah, but good for him. We were annoying. I like that a lot.
And you did.
Very funny to do that to four kids who are annoying.
Do you think you're
chanting
funny
McDonald's.
Because he was funny?
I think I had no idea when I was a kid. I was so intimidated by him. I didn't know how funny he was. You know, things were very dry. When the phone would ring, he'd be like, it's your broker, you know. I kind of knew that was a joke, but like, it was dry. He was not, he never got on the floor and was like, hey, who's this toy? You know, it was like, you know, he wasn't a dad like on the floor being like, how was your day, buddy? You know, who's this? Oh, who's this dinosaur? What do you call him? He'd be like, what are you holding? I once had a toy, and it was like dirty because I'd been playing outside. He goes, "Is that your toy?" And I went, "Yes." He goes, "That's grotesque."
Well, you know, you.
But yes, I became him also. So, like, you asked me if I was funny because he's funny.
Yeah.
There's many things about him that I'm making fun of that in the special I'm like observing. Oh yeah.
That's me too.
Because I appreciate it now, and also we're doomed to always become them.
We are, because it's our only example, and it's beaten into us until that just becomes life.
And also, like, I don't even, maybe karmically, like, the faster you run from it, you know, either way, you're back to it in the end.
It makes me wonder about the nature of a career in comedy versus, your dad is a lawyer.
Yeah.
And I would think that by the nature of him being a lawyer.
And my mom, a law professor.
Right. I would think that saying you wanted to go into comedy, did that give them a little pause?
Pause? It was like, I think my mom was like, this is something I always knew was going to happen because he's been saying it since he was little. And now he's really going to do it. Okay, he's really moving to New York. He's going to do it. My dad, I remember when I was a teen, we were at lunch, you know, having lunch at a restaurant. And he went, you've been saying you want to be a comedian. What does that mean? You want to be like Steve Martin? He said it like, it was like, what do you want to go to the moon? You've been telling people. It was like, what would that be? I don't understand what that is. I don't think he was putting it down, but I don't know if he wasn't putting it down as a non-serious thing.
Right. Well, I get the sense from piecing together stuff I've read on you and watching your special that there was definitely a period, late high school maybe, where things could have gone off the rails. Like, I was surprised to hear how much you drank in high school and that you were like a blackout drunk in high school. And I was curious, like where were his parents? How did he get access to that? And did they know or?
No, I kept up appearances.
You did.
They knew that I might go to a party and drink beer or something. They had an understanding of high school parties and they weren't idiots. But if I was, you know, messing around with drugs when I was very young, I knew to keep up appearances and, you know, I'd be on mushrooms and come through the front door and go, "Hello, good evening, I'm going to be upstairs," you know, and then just like run up and, oh no, I feel, this is all the news to them. But I knew.
But do you think they sort of knew gave you some freedom? No.
No, I don't think so. I really was like, I'm going to keep my grades up and keep up appearances.
So you were sort of leading a double life in a way.
One life was fun of grades and getting high. I also didn't smoke pot. I was an uptight, you know, wanted to get good grades, wanted my teachers to like me person, wanted to be involved, was worried about college, all that stuff. I wasn't that worried about college. I was worried about day-to-day life. And then on the weekends would drink like Keith Moon and, you know, like take Ambien to see what it would do. And, you know, it was a crazy person.
So when you went off to college, did you have this plan like, I'm going to make it in comedy? Like, were you going to be a stand-up and you sort of knew?
I thought, I told my freshman year roommate, I want to be a comedy writer and then maybe have a show like Conan O'Brien.
That's crazy because as much as you didn't have a five-year plan, probably within 5 years of that, you became a comedy writer on Saturday Night Live.
True,
right?
After abandoning that idea, yeah. No, I think I said that because everyone was coming to college with all these like plans.
Right.
I'm gonna be a government major, but then pre-law. I was like, what? Oh, y'all thought about this? I was psyched to be 18 and buy cigarettes and vote for Gore. You all have like job ideas already? But I did say that, and I did end up being a writer at Saturday Night Live, yeah.
Well, something that struck me that I was reading is that in your sort of early days, pre-Saturday Night Live, you said something about you used to dread going on stage and that you hoped the gig would get canceled. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like the reading between the lines, it seemed like something shifted from when you went from dreading that to being excited about the gauntlet of getting up and performing. And I wondered if there was something, some specific thing that where something shifted and you realized like, oh, I actually like this.
Totally. It wasn't dread like stage fright. It was like, this is only going mediocre. You know, I'm up there. I don't know quite what I'm doing. I don't know how to deliver this line, or this idea is falling apart at the seams in front of these people. There's not that many people in the audience to begin with. It's an open mic. This room is weird. They're running the espresso machine while I'm talking. This isn't what I thought it would be. I want to have already done this, was my feeling. I was like, I want to be a comedian, but I am inconvenienced by the steps. Genuinely, like, that sounds like so... I hate that. Like, what a person to not root for. But I really was like, I hate all this bombing and all these like crappy shows. It's really taken away from my Ricky Ricardo dreams.
Yeah.
Of just being in a tuxedo. And I mean, Ira Glass said it best, which is when you start, you're bad. And it really sucks because the fact that you wanted to start probably means you have good taste. So you know what's good and you can't do it. He phrases it very well, and it was exactly that. I was like, I know I can do this. I don't have even the way to talk yet. I don't know anything yet, and I want this part to be over. And also, you know, when you start doing stand up, you do a few open mics. Like, it can be hard to do it every night. Just get stage time in New York.
Right.
So then Mike Birbiglia, who I didn't go to college with, but he went to the same college as me, and he would visit, and he was like, he'd already been on Letterman, and he'd been in the same improv group that I was in. Amazing. I mean, like, amazing. I was like, oh my God, amazing. He had made it. He's on The Late Show with David Letterman. He absolutely turned me into a comedian. He took me both around New York, and I'd watch him do sets, and then he took me on the road for a college tour he did, where in between all the colleges, he booked whatever club was in between them geographically. So we were on the road for, I think, 30 to 40 days straight. Sometimes big college auditoriums, sometimes a comedy club. I always opened the show. I had to go on every night. And he also said, I'm going to take you on the road, but you have to be good. I really, like, really thank him for that. He goes, you can't like, fuck around. Be good. And I was like, okay. And it scared me in the moment.
Right.
And in retrospect, I started to, you know, okay, no, I want to come out strong. I want to be good at this.
So was there something on that tour that shifted where it's like, oh, I actually like this? I like...
Yeah, more advice from Mike. Well, different things. One, doing it, repetition, just getting over the awkwardness of it. I mean, it's strange. Even if you've dreamed of it, it's strange to... take the mic out and do it. It's
right.
Just weird. You're
right.
Just suddenly like, oh, I didn't realize I'd be standing, even though it's called stand-up. Like, I don't, okay, do I look at them? What's going on here? I would do 4-minute sets, and I would bring a beer up on stage with me, because I'd seen comics do that, as if within a 4-minute period, I would need to drink a full beer. I wanted to write jokes about topics no one else had a joke about, thinking that was how I would be original. Like, I'd pick a subject. Like the Liberty Bell.
And oh, okay,
I'd be like,
okay.
No one has a joke about that. That's how I'll be original. I'll have a joke about that. I like didn't understand that originality is about perspective.
Yeah, right, right.
I thought it was like, does anyone have a, yeah, truly, like I like picked a well-known object that no one had a joke about. And like, I did not set out to like do that, but I was like, well, I am kind of making myself laugh. Maybe I should get over my own bullshit about, like, that I'm going to be the most original comic ever. And, you know, we're all in a club in a mall. Acknowledge that. Then later get into your own specifics.
That's a big thing right there, because that's you accepting the reality of the situation and going, I'm here. And that's that
yeah, this
people
is not,
can relate to.
Yeah, this is not a art installation.
Right.
This is entertainment. It's transactional.
Right.
Sometimes, like, okay, comedy snobs, of which I am one, will roll our eyes at people who wear a Hawaiian shirt and then their first joke is about the Hawaiian shirt, right? that old cliche, right?
It's like creating something that you have something to talk about.
Right. Yeah. However, again and again, I am struck by how much one needs a joke about themselves to start when no one knows who you are. I once wore a Shell gas station, like I bought it at a thrift store, and said Shell, it was a Shell gas station shirt. And I went on stage at Penguins in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and I was wearing the shirt, and I did my whole set to silence. And I got off stage, and the waitress was like, "Why didn't you do the Shell character?" And I was like, "What?" And she was like, "Why wouldn't you make jokes about Shell gas station?" And I was like, oh, right.
What you're describing is, you may have had some good material and you may have had some good timing and rhythm, but you couldn't see you the way the audience saw you. You didn't have
and
the whole picture.
And I was too arrogant to respect their involvement. I thought like, no, I'm smart. I love Mr. Show, Conan, weird stuff. I have weird ideas. You will accept them. You're not accepting them. I hate this.
And then that all shifted.
Oh, gradually, and still needs to get better. still same issues all the time. That tour was life-changing.
It was.
Yeah, because I, to follow up, after that I wanted to do stand-up every night.
Okay, so I watched your Saturday Night Live hosting gig a few weeks ago.
Yes.
Which I didn't know, but you're only the third writer to be asked back to host Saturday Night Live.
Third?
I think it was the third, right?
Conan, Larry David.
And you.
Yeah.
Well, I wondered if coming back to host that show, first off, if that's your toughest audience or if that's the monologue or the stand-up where you feel like this is where I have to be great.
Yes.
Because you had written so many monologues for so many people that had
done
the show.
Simon
and
Rich
like,
and I always wrote the monologue for about 2 to 3 years because you can't cut the monologue.
Got it. So you were like, I'll take the monologue.
Simon, my first week, he goes, you know what you and I are going to do? We're going to write the monologue every week because you can't cut the monologue. And I was like, you're smart.
What was that feeling like to come back and go, now I'm the guy? Because I would assume that there could be a tremendous amount of pressure.
I felt that there could be a potential just, you know, like, oh, am I going to go in there? What's it going to be like? Am I going to feel inferior and wrong that I'm on camera because I used to be a writer there and like I liked being behind the scenes so much? How will I feel now completely flipping it, you know?
Right.
Like, I had been a dairy farmer and they're like, you want to be one of the cows? And I was like, I remember what we used to do to the cows. Wait a second.
Right.
I remember how we used to talk about the cows and how we used to manipulate them into doing what we wanted. And so I was like, I hope I can just kind of let go and enjoy it because I'm so nervous about the actual thing of hosting it. And then I showed up and I found it so funny that I was hosting. And everyone else that I had worked with was very happy for me. And not like putting me down, but like, we all found it so funny and weird that I was hosting that. And people would go, nah, but you deserve it, man. I was like, I don't know, who knows? But it's like visiting your family. Like, nerve wracking or, I don't know, however you'd associate that. Like, I'm gonna go to a place that I love, but that I know the ins and outs of. But it was like, oh, there's a lot of history. There's a lot of shared history here.
Right.
And I walked in the door and I was like, yeah, and the shared history was great. And that was really the revelation. I was like, I sometimes remember it like sleepless, chain smoking, you know, host doesn't want to do that. They cut my thing. Oh man, I'm so tired. Like sometimes I just, that's the slideshow. I walked in the door and I was like, oh, right, this was the greatest time ever. I had in one week, a distilled, almost like Frank Capra-esque, like, this was so fortunate that I got to do this for 4 years.
Was it immediately weird to be on the other side?
Yes.
It was like, immediately did you see weird, things yes. differently than you'd seen them before?
Monday, Tuesday was similar, because it was like, it's a lot of, what are you writing? Yeah, okay, I might write this thing where blank happens. Then Wednesday was the table read. And the writers sit in a row of chairs, 3 rows of chairs, on one side of a big table that the cast sits around. And Lauren sits at, and the host sits at, and the director sits at, and a script supervisor sits at. sitting at the table was like, that's when it felt weird, in the host seat.
And was it weird getting a different like camera angle on the
yes,
writers?
Yes, completely. I texted Bill, Fred, and Andy Friday night, I think, when it finally sunk in how crazy the process was. And I had been a writer and producer there. I thought I'd seen every side of it. I texted them and I was like, I had no idea.
Really?
Yeah, I said, I had no idea what you guys had to go through. I thought we had the hardest jobs. I truly, as a writer, I think I got along with everyone. I had a little chip on my shoulder about like, well, we, you know, stay up 4 days in a row writing everything, and technically without us, there wouldn't be any. But I was like, you guys both write crafted material, and you had to be pulled into quick changes, pulled into photo shoots, going into costume fittings, going into wig fittings, going into prosthetic fittings, all of that time in your head wishing you could sit down and rewrite.
It must be mind-blowing to be at one place for so long and then find out there's
yes.
a whole side of it you didn't even ever see. And it's right yeah. there in front of you.
And a side that I was like, I like being a writer. I could control everything. I loved being a writer there. You were like a producer of live TV at 25. You'd write, once your sketch was picked, you went around to every department, discussed with them how it would look, how the costume set, everything, what you were hoping for, the reality of the stage size. The producer, Kenny Amon, would tell you, like, we can't get a full bus into the studio. We can get half a bus, we can get the front of a bus, and we'll have a guy at the wheel, and it'll look like a bus, you know, those types of things. You learn all that, and it's like such a crazy amount of how to put together a TV show knowledge. The one thing I didn't know was how to do that and be on camera.
I'm so curious about that whole time because from what I understand, you originally auditioned to be a performer, right?
Oh yeah, they asked me to audition they see me on Conan as a stand-up.
And when you got asked to write but not perform, was it this combination of getting my dream job and I feel let down that I wasn't a performer, or were you happy?
No. It wasn't like I was happy that I wasn't a performer. It wasn't a negative thing. It was, I auditioned 100% knowing there's no way I'll get cast.
Why'd you think that?
They were flush with male white brunettes. They had the best in the business. I was like, I'm a stand-up. I could not do what they do. And I still can't. And I went in thinking, I'm going to do my favorite stand-up bits, some of which had kind of character-y things in them. But I didn't want to, like, scrap it and try to write, like, a Gordon Ramsay impression.
Right.
Just to, like, you know, be like, look, I can, please let me understand. I was like, I just want to be very funny for them because this will be a cool story that I got to audition for Lorne Michaels.
So no expectations?
Actually, yes, no expectations. That sounds like a lie, but I just wanted to be very funny. I could not, I was like, they shouldn't cast me. They don't have room.
So when you went up and did that almost in a weird way, you think?
I did
take
great.
The pressure off and, yeah.
And everyone would say they didn't laugh in the room. And so you'd go, okay, they're not going to laugh. But it's a cool story, so who cares? And it like went great. Like in the moment, I was like, this is going well, this is weird.
Like people were laughing in the room.
Yeah, I don't mean to be a jerk.
You're not being a jerk. I mean,
but they were laughing.
We weren't there and we want to be there.
I was like, I'm doing the stand-up that I love the most. It's kind of it's character-y, it shows up. I didn't, it was just like, I want to be as funny as possible in front of Lorne Michaels. And more so, like, because, like, oh, that'll be cool, and then we'll part ways for life, you know. And, like, I felt like, I was like, that went well. I still won't get it, but that went well, and that was fun. And then, not the next day, but the day after that, Seth Meyers called me and said, do you want to be a writer? And I was like, absolutely. I actually went back in, oh, this is true and sounds fake, but it's true. I was at dinner with my mom because I was in Chicago. My cell phone rang. I went outside, I took it, it was Seth Meyers. He offered me the job as a writer, and he was like, just so you know, this is as a writer, not a performer. I was like, yeah, of course, there shouldn't be a performer. That's great, that's fantastic, yes, absolutely. I go inside, I told my mom, I just got hired as a writer at SNL, and the waitress was standing right there, and she went, that's how Conan started.
Really?
Yeah. And I didn't finish my meal, and because I was suddenly so nervous, and I didn't have an appetite for like 30 days.
You were so young. I mean, when you look back, and definitely from where I sit, to land in that environment and have it be such hallowed ground of comedy. And something that you said I related to, because you and I were doing the same thing when we were in our 20s, which is we were pitching ideas to celebrities.
Right.
And I guess I was curious about you being young and being a writer and some of the people that you had to interact with, big actors, big celebrities, and you would have to pitch your ideas.
Yeah.
And and that could be a really scary thing from experience.
Yeah. And there were plenty of moments of like hilarious naive arrogance.
Yeah.
Of like, I got this. Or I'd give a line reading to, you know, like Robert De Niro. But just the arrogance of like, here's my idea for you. And even more so if something got picked and was being produced. Saying, I feel like when you come out of the puff of smoke, go like that, you know, like do it a little bigger, like to a comedy legend, or like that thing of where you'd write for the host in your mind. That was the other funny thing is like I'd be like, no, do it like you, like we wrote this for you, so do what we think your signature thing is that you in your head are like, what, like you know, do the thing. Or you go like, get out of here. And they'd be like, I don't do that. And I'd be like, yeah, you do. Do it. Yes, definitely had those moments. Then would be put in my place correctly by some people gently. But like you could see in their eyes, like, do what now? And you go, right, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. It's very sorry. I will say I also learned if someone's unwilling and you can, and I don't know, maybe you had a different experience. If they aren't doing it well a couple times in a row, they don't want to do it.
Yes.
And as much as I believe in my comedy sketch idea and demand that it be on the air, and as much as I'm exhausted and chain smoking and you know I have had too much coffee and I'm like he's doing it wrong. Like I was like, this person doesn't want to do this. And so let's like, we wouldn't pull it, but we'd let's mentally be prepared that this will probably get cut.
Right.
And that's like that's collaborating, which like I learned, I was like, it's something about the wording or something about the way in, it's not clicking with them. They can't wrap their head around it. You don't just jam that into someone's mouth and go, say it, you know, it doesn't work that way.
Was that something where you sort of had to learn how to make peace and?
Yes. Especially with monologues. People would say jokes in a way it'd be like, that was great. I'd like pause right before that part. I think I'd be good, like throwing a little pause. Great, let's do it again. You're like, I think like, but I think it's like, you know, da-da-da-da, right? You know, like I just think that pause will help, you know, do it wrong again. You'd be like, And they'd be like, they'd be like, I don't like that joke. And you go, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're always like, oh, you haven't liked that joke all week. And you, oh, sorry. And like, it's your monologue. And you and I should be working together. Yes. It was a good lesson in like, yeah, I guess you could force people to do things. But also, you gotta work with people more than, I had no other choice but to work with people.
Right. But you know, it's funny you're saying that, and I'm thinking, of course, you end up on the stage at Radio City telling your own most personal stories in your own voice, in your own way.
Right. Yeah, I had that outlet. I can say it exactly the way I want.
Right.
Yeah. Except sometimes on SNL, you get it pure comedy, just right. And the audience, for some reason, there's wind in its sails, and the weirdest thing in the world just goes, and it's great. And the host is into it, and the audience is into it. It's the best.
And is that what you're chasing? Is that the carrot that keeps you kind of going on that show?
Yeah, just those moments of like, that was brilliant. No one, something that no one asked for. No one in the audience knew they wanted. The cast committed, the host loved it. the cards were, we got the right cards, and it is great. And those become like legendary things.
Right.
Kyle Bell famously went to the table 5 times or something.
Oh, is that true?
Yes. A number of times where you'd go, but that's a hit. No, it wasn't. It was about Blue Oyster Cult. It felt like, you know, I can imagine what the strikes in the meeting were against it, you know.
But that kind of proves that nobody knows.
No one knows nothing. Not at all.
Yeah.
Did you ever have something you talked someone into that you thought was a bad idea photo-wise?
Yes. The funny thing is sometimes I would just, when I was younger, I would force my will, and then later I'd look at the pictures and I'd go, oh yeah, yeah, this was dumb. And I had to do it because I bought the horse or I, you know, got the Rockettes down there.
Well, we had that sometimes. We'd get the Foy, flying by Foy. They're a company from Philadelphia with wires that
right.
they fly most people, be it Broadway or Saturday Night Live. So when people on Saturday Night Live are poorly lifted by wires, no offense to the Foy people, it's more about how we should do it. But when they go in the air, that was one company, and it's like, I can get the Foy brothers up here, but you got to let me know now. They got to come from Philadelphia.
Right.
And it was like, get them, you know?
And you're doing the sketch.
Then it's like, you know, we paid... We might want to have them fly around a little, you know, and be like, well, that wasn't getting any laughs. Like, yeah, I know, but I think they should fly around a little.
Right.
Yeah, it's like, it's just, I won't call, Saturday Night Live is an enormously creative place. I'm not calling it a bureaucracy, but when you're doing it with many voices, the pure idea is going to get sometimes improved, but often just kind of banged up a little, you know.
Yeah.
Stand up, you can just say it.
Right.
And also, you say it, and it doesn't do well. And you realize, oh, my pure vision is not good enough and needs to be changed.
But I would think there's also a joy to, it didn't do well in Cleveland, but in Chicago, I'm going to fix it. Like in doing stand-up, you have this opportunity to keep tinkering with it.
Till you tape it, and that's...
Right.
Yeah, then cameras are there. Cameras change things. And live performance is ephemeral. And it's like... On this night, this happened, and it was great, and it will never happen again. And you will never see it if you weren't there.
Do you love that aspect of it?
I really learned to love it after doing the Broadway show, Oh Hello, with Nick Kroll.
Right.
Our director, Alex Timbers, actually said that, who directed Kid Gorgeous and is goddamn genius, said at the rap party of Oh Hello, he said, I do theater because it is ephemeral. It is never permanent, and it is never correct. It is never locked. It is never the final. And I really like that. I love making the specials, but I also love the fact that for 150 shows before the special, it was whatever happened in that room.
See, that's got to be the ultimate lesson in letting go enough of expectations to let things happen and then see that art is always sort of a mystery, right? Like, is that the part?
Oh, I would encourage people to have no expectations about anything. Yeah, have no expectations. But yeah, that helped. That helped and helps and makes it fun. This is worth the Academy of Music in Philadelphia, and it's snowing, and I'm in this like weird good mood, and this is this show. And I'm gonna, I trust these people. I'm gonna toss in this detail or this joke. And it's like, and then sometimes it stays forever. But it happens because of that one moment, you know.
Well, what a crazy career when you think about it, and a crazy job you have, because what you're saying is that there's a certain part of it that will always be mysterious, that nobody knows what's going to be funny. From the example of the cowbell being rejected a number of times to
ideas that I thought would work. Yeah.
Yeah, or this offhand comment about your father that turns out to be a door that opens up a whole new perspective on him that you can relate to an audience. And all of a sudden you're in real artist territory there I'm creating something totally original. But I guess what I'm saying is that dream of being a kid and wanted to read magazines in a diner all day and work for 10 minutes a night in a nightclub.
Yeah.
And eventually get to the point where you're really, let's face it, you're really just telling truthful stories in a way that like are connecting with people. Like, who's to say what laughter is or, you know, it's like...
Oh, yeah, and that they're laughing at it right now.
Right.
You know, try to get it right, you know, in that moment, describing how something feels, and they're laughing. Tonight they're laughing, and that's great.
I feel like I could talk about comedy all day and still not even scratch the surface of it.
Well, so could I. I don't understand it.
Did we learn anything here today?
No. Have no expectations, have no plans. What else?
But how do you trust
Drop your backpack if someone's chasing you.
That's right. Straight smarts.
JJ.
No, but you know, that's a confident position to take, that have no expectations, have no plans, and somehow it's going to work out. Like your dad.
I don't know if it's going to work out.
But it has.
Yes, yes. Oh, please don't
so
think
far,
I'm...
So far, it's working out
Please
great.
Don't think I'm taking it for granted.
No.
Yeah. But you have no choice. I would encourage people to have no expectations, because I'm not sure if you know this, but you have no idea what's going to happen.
That's true.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. It's been fascinating talking.
This was great. I'd do this 5 more hours. This
great.
Is great.
Let's go.
Okay,
that's
let's
hour
keep going.
One.
That's hour one.
Let's go to the bathroom.
This
we'll
is
come
like
back.
Frost Nixon. Yeah.
Hey, folks. That's our show for this time. I hope you learned something about comedy, or at least you learned that nobody knows anything about comedy. But if you want to see some of John's comedy, make sure you check out his newest special on Netflix, John Mulaney, Kid Gorgeous at Radio City. And also look up his recent SNL appearance, in which he not only hosts, but finally gets to bring to fruition his long gestating sketch, The Lobster. It's hilarious, and for those of you who miss Les Miserables, you're in luck. As you know, we are also a television show, and I want to thank each and every one of you for listening to the podcast, and I want to invite each and every one of you to see what these words look like. You can go to DirecTV's Audience Network, where we are on multiple times a week, or you can go to offcamera.com and get yourself a monthly subscription. Now, with that subscription, you can watch every episode we've ever done for only $4.99 a month. That's every episode as many times as you want on any device. It is a great way to experience the full depth and breadth of this show, and I encourage you to check it out. Also, while you're at offcamera.com, go to our store. We have some great items. We have a coffee table book, we have tons of print magazines, and even some special signed memorabilia. And whenever you buy something at the Off Camera store, you're supporting us and helping our effort to keep this show in the air. So check that out. And if you're on social media, take a minute and tell everyone why you like the show. We are Off Camera Show at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And I am Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram and Sam Jones on Twitter. And if you want to drop me a line and give me a guest suggestion, or just tell me your story, or send me a recipe for your favorite shrimp tacos, I am sam@offcamera.com. I'm serious about the recipes, too. I feel like I'm in a cooking rut. So send me an email and tell us what you think of the show. I would love to hear from you. I want to thank everyone that helps us out each week to make this show a reality. Crawford Shippey, Michaela Galvin, Nathan Shields, Sasha Snow, Kara Johnson, and Matt Garbage Disposal Fingers Davidson. We couldn't do the show without all of these talented people, so a big thank you goes out to them. Now, most importantly, make sure to join me next time when I sit down with actor Peter Krause.
The eighth grade, spring band concert, I remember I was in the backyard mowing the lawn, and it was that night, and I thought, I'm just not going to go. I did this for 4 years, played an instrument I didn't want to play, and I was done with it. I went to school, and I saw Mr. Herzog, and he saw me, and he came marching right towards me and goes, why weren't you at the concert? I thought, I'm just going to tell him the truth. I said, I didn't want to go. And I mean, his face just red, and like, he goes, well, I'm going to have to give you an F. And I looked at him, and I said, okay. And I got an F in band. So what? There are those little moments in life where, for whatever reason, no, man, I'm not going to be who I'm supposed to be anymore. I'm going to go do what I want to do.
This is a treat for me. I have been a fan of Peter's work since I first saw him on Aaron Sorkin's beloved and over-too-soon series, Sports Night. He then went on to star in two of my favorite television series ever, 6 Feet Under and Parenthood, the latter of which was so relatable that I almost felt like I was taking weekly parenting lessons from his character, Adam Braverman. Well, after talking to him, I now know why. Peter says the work of an actor is to illuminate the human condition, a skill he deploys with deft accuracy on the hearts and guts of viewers. But it was his own personal story that got to my heart most of all, in one of the most intimate conversations I have ever had on this show. See you next time, off camera.